You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 14, given in Dornach on April 3rd, 1920. I have been thinking for a long time about how to approach today's topic in this lecture series, as I will be able to present it only superficially, owing to the shortage of time. I have been pondering whether or not to include it, and have decided to do so, even though it will show us once again how easily such matters can be misunderstood. You see, for a long time now, certain people have been launching their attacks on anthroposophy, by suggesting that anthroposophical statements are just confused nonsense. Now, however, the opinion seems to be emerging that it is no longer possible to make this suggestion, because belated research shows that the matters we discuss give all too strong an impression of agreeing with what can be derived from the ancient mysteries. So now people are inventing the objection that I am betraying the mysteries. It will always be possible for them to formulate their objections in a way that suits their purpose. If they can no longer say that the contents are false, they will at least claim that it is quite wrong to talk about them. What I want to say first of all is this. We must realize that the physical perspective reveals only a small portion of any human being, for the obvious reason that the human being also includes the etheric body, the astral body, and the eye, which are constantly and independently active and working on the human organism, and which naturally elude external physical assessment completely. I use the term assessment advisedly in view of what I want to present shortly. But this does not mean that it is impossible for individuals of good will to train their intellect and capacity for judgment to absorb aspects of what we might call clairvoyance. These individuals will not achieve clairvoyance of the sort that deals with clear images, but they will achieve a method of evaluation that is at least able to establish a strong and valid relationship to clairvoyant insight. Please consider the following. Let us begin with how the eye works on the human being. Because human beings are what they are in our present period of evolution, the capital I works first and foremost on the human physical body. In present-day humankind, it has relatively little ability to master even the etheric body. In childhood, the eye still governs the etheric body in a relatively dull and unconscious way. But later it no longer controls the etheric body at all. It retains a very strong influence on the etheric body only in those whose imagination remains strong in later life. In general, however, in people who become intellectual in a dry and rational way, the eye has a stronger influence on the physical body than on the etheric body. If you imagine properly what I have described as the influence of the eye on the physical body, you will be quite close to also being able to imagine that this eye works on the physical organization, setting up a kind of scaffolding throughout. Our physical body really does incorporate something resembling a delicate scaffolding, which can be seen as a kind of phantom that is constantly present. We carry around within us a scaffolding that has been impressed upon us by our eye organization. A very delicate scaffolding that is incorporated into the organization of the physical body out of the forces of the etheric body. In the course of a lifetime, however, we gradually lose the strength to incorporate this scaffolding consciously, although it remains present in our imaginative creativity in a semi-conscious, dreamy way. you can easily see that to a certain extent, the scaffolding the eye builds into the human organism is a foreign object, and so the human organism constantly defends itself against this scaffolding and attempts to destroy it every night during sleep. Even though we perceive very little of this scaffolding in everyday life, we must not forget that it tends to splinter or fall apart within the organism. For this reason, it is the constant, mysterious cause of inflammations in the organism. It is very important to consider that a phantom of sorts is built into the human organism by the eye, that the organism defends itself against this phantom as if it were a foreign object, and that this foreign object constantly tends to splinter and fall apart within the human being's physical organization. You can get a more or less reasonable view of this scaffolding simply by studying the organization of human eyes from a psychophysiological perspective. The entire interplay between the eyes and the outer world, or the interplay between the soul and the outer world that takes place through the eyes, is representative of the building of this scaffolding in its purest form. There is a relationship between the capital I scaffolding and what comes about through the interaction of the eyes with the environment. When I say eyes, it's EYES. And I have often studied this relationship in people who were born blind and in people who have become blind. This makes it very easy to compare the interrelationship between the one phantom, which is a normal phantom in most people, and is incorporated into their organization simply through the fact that they see, and the other phantom, which is the consequence of eye activity in the organism. To express these phenomena graphically, I might say that through seeing, through the visual process, a phantom scaffolding is incorporated into the organism, and there's a drawing. The other scaffolding, which is incorporated through the eye process, simply lies a bit deeper within the organism and gives a clear indication of physical forces. What the eye builds into the organization is a nearly physical phantom, an actual scaffolding, while what the eyes supply is still etheric. It is interesting to see how close these two come to each other in nearsighted people, how what I have sketched here in white comes very close to the other scaffolding, the yellow. In contrast, in far-sighted people, the white scaffolding moves outward. In short, if you study the organization of a person's eyes, you will be able to get a reasonable understanding of that person's etheric body, which is very similar to what I have described here as one of the scaffolds. There is no better way of training yourself to grasp certain aspects of a person's etheric body than by paying attention to the organization of that person's eyes. The rest will come by itself. If you develop the habit of paying attention to whether people are near or far-sighted and allow the observation to work on you, this habit trains you to be receptive to perceiving the etheric body. If you then also assist this process by meditating, it will no longer be so difficult for you to move on from dedicated study of what the organization of the eyes evokes in the human being to a study of the etheric body. Next, you will convince yourself of the following. The process that is related to the organization of the eyes is always present in the human being. It is a normal token of a tendency that can also appear in an abnormal form. It is a normal process in everyday life, but something similar appears in all inflammatory conditions. You can really say that if the scaffolding in the physical body, the one that is similar to the etheric body, emerges too strongly, it gives rise to inflammations and their consequences. The conviction that is dawning in you can be strengthened by experimenting with external applications of formic acid, derived from the animal kingdom. This is easy to do. You simply obtain the highest possible dilution of formic acid and administer it to your patient in the form of baths. You are then met by a consolidation of this yellow scaffolding here, again referring to the drawing. Through the use of formic acid, the capital I is harnessed to and pervades the scaffolding. If your patient is predisposed to inflammations, this is how you can cope with them, because the scaffolding tends to fall apart and trigger inflammations only when it is not properly pervaded by the eye, since the scaffolding and the eye belong together. They can be brought together by using formic acid in baths, as I have just described. But the formic acid must be highly diluted, because only then do its forces become fully available. You must pursue symptomatology a bit if you become involved in such matters. You must observe, for example, whether your patients with inflammatory conditions tend toward obesity. You will achieve good results with the above-mentioned external therapy, with animal-derived formic acid, only if both predispositions are present. On the one hand, a tendency to inflammations, and on the other, an inclination to obesity, which points to a certain syndrome. If you have reason to suspect a breakdown of this scaffolding, which you can recognize from various other symptoms we will discuss later, and if you are simultaneously dealing with a patient who is quite strongly predisposed to obesity, you will always achieve extremely beneficial results. This is what must be taken into consideration. You see, in this case, spiritual scientific knowledge is very shocking to modern individuals. Spiritual science knows that the process that must occur in the human organism, so that the eyes develop in the way that they must in human evolution, through a long developmental history, of course, is an inflammatory process that is constantly kept within normal limits, so that it does not erupt into inflammation. If you imagine that the same process that is at work in inflammation is held back, slowed down, and compressed, you have the process that forms the eyes in the human organism. From the very appearance of a person's eyes, you can gain an impression of whether or not that person is predisposed to inflammatory conditions. You will be able to see it in people's eyes if you train yourself to observe it. What we can experience about people's vision really is intimately related to observing the human etheric body. And when we speak of the presence of the etheric body, of learning to perceive the etheric body, there is, of course, the inner process that leads to actual clairvoyance by way of meditation. But there is also the possibility of self-education from the outside. By attempting to view natural processes in the right way, we acquire insight into them from the perspective of judgment. You see, the organs of clairvoyance must be developed from within, but we develop our capacity for judgment in conjunction with the outer world. If we do this on a more intimate level, our capacity for judgment meets up with the otherwise more intimate meditative process that moves from within outward. You may be justified in raising the question of whether all this cannot be observed in the animal kingdom too. The situation is this. We do not gain a good idea of what is at issue in the human being by studying the same thing in animals. In public lectures, I have often emphasized a point that I want to emphasize here as well, but in greater detail. You see, people think that eyes are eyes, organs are organs, lungs are lungs, livers are livers, and so on. This is not true, however. Human eyes are the same organs as the eyes that are present in an animal, but they are modified by the fact that the I is incorporated into the human being, and the same is true of all the other organs. And with respect to what happens in an organ, which plays a very great role in a human being who is ill, by the way, the fact that it is pervaded by the I is more important than the aspect that also appears in the animal kingdom, where the organ is not pervaded by the I. This is a circumstance that is never taken into account sufficiently. People really never cease to judge these issues on this basis. Here is a knife, and there is a knife. A knife is a knife, and I insist that these are both knives on the basis of how they were made. Yes, but if one knife is a piece of silverware, and the other is a straight razor, it becomes impossible to insist that one knife is the same as the other. It is the same when someone comes along and insists that human eyes and animal eyes can be explained in the same way. It is simply nonsense to attempt to derive the principle that explains something exclusively from that thing's external appearance. This approach leads nowhere, especially if we base a study on mere outer appearances. Animal studies prevent us from examining certain circumstances in humans in the right way, because we can properly call these circumstances to mind only when we are conscious of the fact that the human being's most peripheral organs are the most thoroughly pervaded and shaped by the eye. Human ears are formed in a completely different way from the eyes. We can also comprehend human ears, however. We can train ourselves to understand them objectively, in a way that is similar to how we train ourselves to objectively understand the eyes. Parenthesis, this latter type of self-education brings us close to clairvoyant perception of the etheric body. Close parenthesis. We can school ourselves to see the facts in the right way, namely, that the ears are incorporated into the human being, just as they are in the animal, but that in the human being their formation is then pervaded by the eye organization. If we study the formation of the ears, we discover that they are related to a somewhat more internal aspect of the human organism, just as the etheric body's formation of the eyes is related to a more peripheral aspect. We become able to direct our powers of observation toward ear formation, and to say that the eye has a role in this process, just as it also has a role in forming the eyes. The eye also incorporates a scaffolding into the organism that is somewhat different from the scaffolding described earlier. This one is related to everything that underlies ear formation in the organism. I will sketch this second scaffolding in here in blue, same drawing, page 201. It lies deeper within the organism than the yellow one, and has less of an organizing effect as it extends into the limbs. If we were to extract it from the human being, we would find that it has only stumps instead of arms and legs. We might call it a scaffolding that has remained as an infant in its development. It is also much less differentiated in the direction of the head than the other scaffolding. Once again, we discover a correspondence, this time between the second scaffolding and the organizing forces in human ear formation and all that underlies this process. I will draw it here in violet so that it corresponds to the white. Like the first scaffolding, the second one also possesses a certain idiosyncrasy within the human organism. It, too, can become abnormal, so to speak, when the eye is working too strongly. In this case, when the eye is working too powerfully in the interior. We dealt earlier with the case of the eye working with too much force at the surface. Once again, here is a circumstance that can help you study this subject properly. Pursue a bit of symptomatology, and consider people who tend to be excessively or even slightly underweight, who have no tendency to put on weight. In such people, the eye works too strongly toward the interior and strengthens this second scaffolding. But in contrast to the first scaffolding, this one has a different peculiarity. It tends to proliferate internally, while the first one tends to splinter and fall apart. This one needs to be developed in two directions in particular. It needs to be developed in such a way that the proliferation that results from the eye slipping out of it does not occur. Parenthesis, proliferation and breakdown in these scaffoldings are both due to the fact that the eye is not properly contained within them and slips out. Close parenthesis. If the eye slips out of this scaffolding, but it is strong enough to maintain itself within the organism, psychological and physical consequences will develop. The psychological consequence is hypochondria. The physical consequence is constipation or similar symptoms. This is one possibility. It is also possible, however, for the eye to be too weak to hold together when it slips out. It may fall apart as an eye, so that the cause of the breakdown is the eye itself, rather than its correlate, the physical scaffolding. Imagine what a strange state of affairs this is. In this instance, the eye is so weak that fragments of it establish themselves in the organism. This is the true fact of the matter. These fragments become established because when people with this type of organization fall asleep, they are not able to take everything that slips out of the scaffolding with them. Part of it remains inside and proliferates as an eye on the soul level. Human organisms subject to proliferations of the soul eye, which appear especially strongly during sleep, are predisposed to tumor formation. We are looking at an infinitely important process. People who are predisposed to tumor formations do not sleep properly, because fragments of the eye remain behind in the organism when these people fall asleep. Here we confront these eye fragments, which are the triggers of malignant tumors, and which are related to the entire syndrome I have just described. It is truly as if on the one hand we have hypochondria and constipation, and on the other the organism, if it cannot help itself by turning the person into a constipated hypochondriac, proliferates internally, and malignant tumors appear. We will talk about this at greater length, but for now the point is simply to look at the principle. You can also convince yourself outwardly of the facts of the matter by taking a different view of a topic I discussed earlier, namely that the first formative process we mentioned can be dealt with by externally administering finely dispersed animal formic acid in the form of baths. Try administering an appropriate potentized preparation of the same formic acid internally and observe the effect it has, especially on thin people. In thin people, it influences tumor formation, driving out the tendency to tumor formation. These effects absolutely must be observed on the macroscopic level. They demonstrate the importance of acquiring an eye, EYE, for the macroscopic, for seeing a person's entire status and all aspects of his or her constitution in conjunction with what appears when the person is ill. They also give us a real sense of the need to separate a remedy's external and internal effects. If we trace the efficacy of the same remedy in its external and internal applications, we discover very interesting information. Once again, spiritual science is tremendously informative with regard to this second aspect of the human organization. It tells us that all of the forces that shape human ears lie on the same path as the forces that ultimately lead to internal tumor formation, if they go too far. Our ear formation is the result of a process that is normalized by holding back the tumor-forming force at the right stage. The ear is an internal tumor in the human being, but kept within normal limits. In the process of human development, the factor that shapes the eye, EYE, is related to the inflammatory process, while the factor that shapes the ear is related to the tumor-forming process. Here we see a wonderful connection between health and illness in the human being. We are dealing with the same activities in both health and illness, but in one instance they take place at the right speed, and in the other at the wrong speed. If you were to do away with the inflammatory process in nature, not a creature would be able to see. Sight is possible simply because the inflammatory process is integrated into nature as a whole. It has a specific tempo, however. If the wrong speed is imposed on it, it turns into the pathological process of inflammation in the human being. Similarly, the tumor-forming or proliferative process is significant in the natural world when it takes place at the correct speed. If you were to do away with this process, not a creature in the world would be able to hear. If you give it the wrong speed, however, you end up with everything that takes place in the development of myomas, carcinomas, and sarcomas. We will have more to say about these matters later. If we are not in a position to seek out the healthy counterpart of each individual disease process, we cannot incorporate the disease process into the human organization in the right way, because it is simply true that this human organization is based on centrally internalizing certain processes that are scattered about on the periphery in nature as a whole. Instead of many of the subjects that our modern physiology beats to death, we should be looking at other subjects. Although these other matters are studied, their great importance has not been recognized. Take another example. On a macroscopic and even trivial level, you can trace how the skin that is spread out over the body turns inward so that its continuations cover all of the internal parts. This reversal of functions, which occurs between the cheeks or outer parts of the face and the inside of the lips, for example, is extremely important. Here we can still see in the outer human being the rudiments of a process that ought to be traced properly in embryology, where cavities and involutions are all important. It would be tremendously instructive to pursue such topics simply by studying the differences in reactions when we apply formic acid externally to the skin and internally to the mucosae, noting the subtle difference that appears. Everything I have indicated here represents only details of something that appears on a fundamental level, as I have most recently described. If you conduct such studies, you will encounter the great difference between the aspect of human organization that simply turns itself inside out toward the outside, etherically as well, and the internal centralizing aspect, which are polar opposites. This is important to the following consideration. If you ask what the second phantom I described, the one sketched in blue, corresponds to, I will tell you that it is a physical scaffolding in the organism that simply has a tendency to proliferate. If it remains within normal limits, it is related to the development of the ear. Train yourself to observe the human being in a way that teaches you how to look at the organization of the human ear, and especially at how it is entirely internalized, while considering the organization of the eye at the same time, EYE. Consider the fact that the visual process takes place in the etheric, while the auditory process takes place in the air. This is a significant difference. Everything on the lower end of the series of tangibles and intangibles is more closely related to the factor in the human being that is centralized and shifted into the interior, while everything that is more closely associated with the etheric is related to the human factor that is shifted toward the periphery. What I have sketched here in violet contains nothing less than an indication of what lives within the human astral body. By studying the organization of the ear, you can train yourself to use your capacity for judgment to observe human beings. This observation is a substitute of sorts for clairvoyant perception of the astral body. Learning to observe sight trains us to observe the etheric body, while learning to observe hearing trains us to observe the astral body. If we consider people who are born deaf and people who become deaf, it is possible to make very interesting observations, and more profound associations in nature are revealed. Take note of the following example. As early as childhood, the congenitally deaf would have been predisposed to the worst sorts of tumor formation if they had not been born deaf. This is another one of the natural aids nature creates, and it points beyond what can be understood as the individual human organization between birth and death to an influence that intervenes in repeated earthly lives, because that is where it is balanced out. If we trace each phenomena to a certain extent, we reach a point where we begin to grasp the reality of repeated earthly lives. If you attempt to stimulate the human being peripherally, you will always strengthen what I characterized as the relationship of the I, capital, to its first scaffolding. If you find it necessary to strengthen the human I, you can choose either an educational route or a therapeutic route. If you note a predisposition to inflammations, you will always find that you need to strengthen the activity of the I in your patient. This I activity simply needs to be incorporated into its phantom scaffolding in the right way, so that the scaffolding will not fall apart. The activity of the I can be significantly strengthened, so that it fits into its scaffolding very well, by having your patient take baths to which highly diluted oil of rosemary, the sap expressed from rosemary leaves, is added. The stimulation, coming from the periphery via the finely dispersed rosemary sap, enables the eye to work within what approaches the person in this way. You will find that the most remarkable phenomena begin to appear. Consider how the human eyes are incorporated into the organism. The process of seeing is based on the fact that the eye is able to pervade what is extracted from the human organism at this spot. There is very little animal activity in the eyes. It is all shifted to the vegetative level. And the process of seeing is based on the fact that the human being, the inner human being of soul and spirit, pervades something that is no longer animal-like and can identify with what is external rather than only with internal factors. If you identify with a muscle, you identify with the human formative process from within outward. But when you identify with the eyes, you are identifying with the outer world. This is why I once said that an organ such as an eye is a gulf that extends from the outer world into the human being. It is a piece of the outer world that has simply pushed its way into the organism like a gulf. Again, sense physiology makes a fatal error by totally failing to take such considerations into account. And this is the origin of those silly stories about subjectivity and so forth. Objectivity pushes its way into us. In this objectivity, we participate in a bit of the external world process. This is not taken into account at all today. For centuries, or at least for a century and a half, all sorts of sense physiology has been based on the subjective, because no one thought about how the outer world pushes its way in through its gulfs, as it were, so that we participate in it through our senses. If you grasp this correctly, you will also have a correct understanding of what happens when a very finely dispersed substance works in from outside. If this is the skin, there's a picture, with its pores and all the processes that are played out in connection with the pores, and if droplets of rosemary are finely dispersed in a bath, it will be easy for you to see that an interaction comes about between the skin and the finely dispersed rosemary droplets. This interaction evokes something similar to the stimulation of a sensory process. And this stimulating sensory process works on the human eye, incorporating it into its scaffolding. We can even go so far as to prevent the peripheral process of hair loss, if it is not too late, of course, if it is done in time, by supporting the scalp through the stimulating effect of rosemary droplets, finely dispersed in liquid. It is simply a question of doing this correctly. This is an example of an effect working on the surface, on the periphery of the human organization. Let us assume that the orderly interaction between the eye, capital, and the human organization is broken through from outside. The eye is really not just a point. It is a point that affects its surroundings, which means that the human organization's formative force, the I organizing force, capital I, spreads throughout the human being and pervades everything. If injury occurs from outside to some part of the body, interrupting the interaction between the capital I and the force of the human organization, what you will need to summon to this spot must come from the astral organization, which is one stage lower than the I, and pervades the human being in a way that makes it easier for the eye to develop its therapeutic powers at the place where external injury has taken place. If you want to tell the astral body, which I have described as being located deeper in the interior, as even its phantom indicates, to come to a particular spot and help, you do not administer a bath. Instead, you wrap arnica in a woolen rag and apply an arnica compress to a sprain or similar external injury where the effect of the eye has been weakened. In this way, you summon the astral body from the interior to come to the aid of the eye. This is an example of a remedy working as a balancing factor on the surface or periphery of the human being. This gives us a real basis for comparing different substances in the outer world in terms of whether their readily dispersed constituents aid the periphery, which means that these dispersing substances must be administered in the form of a bath that directly supports the eye, or whether other substances, including arnica in particular, must be applied in order to summon the astral body, which supports the eye indirectly. We discover the effects of such substances only by asking the eye and the astral body to help. As you see, this is knowledge that can really lay the foundations for a theory of external and internal therapy. The end of Lecture 14.